But Dr. Pritchett said that our culture is dying because our universities have to depend on the alms of the meat packers, the steel puddlers, and the purveyors of breakfast cereals. Why had she married him, he thought. That bright, crisp voice was not talking at random. She knew why he had come here. She knew what it would do to him to see her pick up a silver buffer and go on talking gaily, polishing her fingernails. She was talking about the party. But she did not mention Bertram Scudder or Dagny Taggart. What had she sought in marrying him? He felt the presence of some cold, driving purpose within her, but found nothing to condemn. She had never tried to use him. She made no demands on him. She found no satisfaction in the prestige of industrial power. She spurned it. She preferred her own circle of friends. She was not after money. She spent little. She was indifferent to the kind of extravagance he could have afforded. He had no right to accuse her, he thought, or ever to break the bond. She was a woman of honor in their marriage. She wanted nothing material from him. He turned and looked at her wearily. "Next time you give a party," he said, "stick to your own crowd. Don't invite what you think are my friends. I don't care to meet them socially." She laughed, startled and pleased. "I don't blame you, darling," she said. He walked out, adding nothing else. What did she want from him, he thought. What was she after? In the universe as he knew it, there was no answer. Chapter 7. The Exploiters and the Exploited. The rails rose through the rocks to the oil derricks, and the oil derricks rose to the sky. Dagny stood on the bridge, looking up at the crest of the hill where the sun hit a spot of metal on the top of the highest rigging. It looked like a white torch lighted over the snow on the ridges of Wyatt Oil. By spring, she thought, the track would meet the line growing toward it from Cheyenne. She let her eyes follow the green-blue rails that started from the derricks, came down, went across the bridge, and passed her. She turned her head to follow them through the miles of clear air as they went on in great curves hung on the sides of the mountains, far to the end of the new track, where a locomotive crane, like an arm of naked bones and nerves, moved tensely against the sky. A tractor went past her, loaded with green-blue bolts. The sound of drills came as a steady shudder from far below, where men swung on metal cables, cutting the straight stone drop of the canyon wall to reinforce the abutments of the bridge. Down the track she could see men working, their arms stiff with the tension of their muscles as they gripped the handles of electric tie tampers. "Muscles, Miss Taggart," Ben Neely, the contractor, had said to her. "Muscles. That's all it takes to build anything in the world." No contractor equal to McNamara seemed to exist anywhere. She had taken the best she could find. No engineer on the Taggart staff could be trusted to supervise the job. All of them were skeptical about the new metal. "Frankly, Miss Taggart," her chief engineer had said, "since it is an experiment that nobody has ever attempted before, I do not think it's fair that it should be my responsibility." "It's mine," she had answered. He was a man in his 40s who still preserved the breezy manner of the college from which he had graduated. Once, Taggart Transcontinental had had a chief engineer, a silent, gray-haired, self-educated man who could not be matched on any railroad. He had resigned 5 years ago. She glanced down over the bridge. She was standing on a slender beam of steel above a gorge that had cracked the mountains to a depth of 1,500 feet. Far at the bottom, she could distinguish the dim outlines of a dry riverbed, of piled boulders, of trees contorted by centuries. She wondered whether boulders, tree trunks, and mussels could ever bridge that canyon. She wondered why she found herself thinking suddenly that cave dwellers had lived naked on the bottom of that canyon for ages. She looked up at the Wyatt oil fields. The track broke into sidings among the wells. She saw the small disks of switches dotted against the snow. They were metal switches of the kind that were scattered in thousands, unnoticed, throughout the country. But these were sparkling in the sun, and the sparks were greenish-blue. What they meant to her was hour upon hour of speaking quietly, evenly, patiently, trying to hit the centerless target that was the person of Mr. Mowen, president of the Amalgamated Switch and Signal Company, Incorporated of Connecticut. But, Miss Taggart, my dear Miss Taggart, my company has served your company for generations. Why, your grandfather was the first customer of my grandfather, so you cannot doubt our eagerness to do anything you ask, but... Did you say switches made of Riordan metal? Yes. But, Miss Taggart, consider what it would mean having to work with that metal. Do you know that the stuff won't melt under less than 4,000 degrees? Great. Well, maybe that's great for motor manufacturers. But what I'm thinking of is that it means a new type of furnace, a new process entirely, men to be trained, schedules upset, work rules shot, everything balled up, and then God only knows whether it will come out right or not. How do you know, Miss Taggart? How can you know when it's never been done before? Well, I can't say that that metal is good, and I can't say that it isn't. Well, no, I can't tell whether it's a product of genius, as you say, or just another fraud, as a great many people are saying, Miss Taggart. A great many... Well, no, I can't say that it does matter one way or the other, because who am I to take a chance on a job of this kind? She had doubled the price of her order. Reardon had sent two metallurgists to train Moen's men, to teach, to show, to explain every step of the process, and had paid the salaries of Moen's men while they were being trained. She looked at the spikes in the rail at her feet. They meant the night when she had heard that Summit Casting of Illinois, the only company willing to make spikes of Riordan metal, had gone bankrupt, with half of her order undelivered. She had flown to Chicago that night. She had got three lawyers, a judge, and a state legislator out of bed. She had bribed two of them and threatened the others. She had obtained a paper that was an emergency permit of a legality no one would ever be able to untangle. She had had the padlock doors of the Summit Casting plant unlocked, and a random half-dressed crew working at the smelters before the windows had turned gray with daylight. The crews had remained at work under a Taggart engineer and a Riordan metallurgist. The rebuilding of the Rio Norte line was not held up. She listened to the sound of the drills. The work had been held up once, when the drilling for the bridge abutments was stopped. "I couldn't help it, Miss Taggart," Ben Neely had said, offended. "You know how fast drill heads wear out. I had them on order, but Incorporated Tool ran into a little trouble. They couldn't help it either. Associated Steel was delayed in delivering the steel to them, so there's nothing we can do but wait." "It's no use getting upset, Miss Taggart. I'm doing my best." "I've hired you to do a job, not to do your best, whatever that is." "That's a funny thing to say." "That's an unpopular attitude, Miss Taggart, mighty unpopular." "Forget Incorporated Tool. Forget the steel. Order the drill heads made of Riordan metal." "Not me. I've had enough trouble with the damn stuff in that rail of yours. I'm not going to mess up my own equipment. A drill head of Riordan metal will outlast three of steel." "Maybe." "I said order them made." "Who's going to pay for it?" "I am." "Who's going to find somebody to make them?" She had telephoned Riordan. He had found an abandoned tool plant long since out of business. Within an hour, he had purchased it from the relatives of its last owner. Within a day, the plant had been reopened. Within a week, drill heads of Riordan metal had been delivered to the bridge in Colorado. She looked at the bridge. It represented a problem badly solved, but she had had to accept it. The bridge, 1,200 feet of steel across the Black Gap, was built in the days of Nat Taggart's son. It was long past the stage of safety. It had been patched with stringers of steel, then of iron, then of wood. It was barely worth the patching. She had thought of a new bridge of Riordan metal. She had asked her chief engineer to submit a design and an estimate of the cost. The design he had submitted was the scheme of a steel bridge, badly scaled down to the greater strength of the new metal. The cost made the project impossible to consider. "I beg your pardon, Miss Taggart," he had said, offended. "I don't know what you mean when you say that I haven't made use of the metal. This design is an adaptation of the best bridges on record. What else did you expect?" "A new method of construction." "What do you mean, a new method?" "I mean that when men got structural steel, they did not use it to build steel copies of wooden bridges." She had added wearily, "Get me an estimate on what we'll need to make our old bridge last for another 5 years." "Yes, Miss Taggart," he had said cheerfully. "If we reinforce it with steel, we'll reinforce it with Riordan metal." "Yes, Miss Taggart," he had said coldly. She looked at the snow-covered mountains. Her job had seemed hard at times in New York. She had stopped for blank moments in the middle of her office, paralyzed by despair at the rigidity of time which she could not stretch any further. On a day when urgent appointments had succeeded one another, when she had discussed worn diesels, rotting freight cars, failing signal systems, falling revenues, while thinking of the latest emergency on the Rio Norte construction. When she had talked, with the vision of two streaks of green-blue metal cutting across her mind. When she had interrupted the discussions, realizing suddenly why a certain news item had disturbed her, and seized the telephone receiver to call long distance, to call her contractor to say, "Where do you get the food from for your men?" "I thought so." "Well, Barton and Jones of Denver went bankrupt yesterday. Better find another supplier at once if you don't want to have a famine on your hands." She had been building the line from her desk in New York. It had seemed hard. But now she was looking at the track. It was growing. It would be done on time. She heard sharp, hurried footsteps and turned. A man was coming up the track. He was tall and young. His head of black hair was hatless in the cold wind. He wore a workman's leather jacket. But he did not look like a workman. There was too imperious an assurance in the way he walked. She could not recognize the face until he came closer. It was Ellis Wyatt. She had not seen him since that one interview in her office. He approached, stopped, looked at her and smiled. "Hello, Dagny," he said. In a single shock of emotion, she knew everything the two words were intended to tell her. It was forgiveness, understanding, acknowledgement. It was a salute. She laughed like a child, in happiness that things should be as right as that. "Hello," she said, extending her hand. His hand held hers an instant longer than a greeting required. It was their signature under a score settled and understood. "Tell Neely to put up new stone fences for a mile and a half on Granada Pass," he said. "The old ones are rotted. They won't stand through another storm. Send him a rotary plow. What he's got is a piece of junk that wouldn't sweep a backyard. The big snows are coming any day now." She considered him for a moment. "How often have you been doing this?" she asked. "What?" "Coming to watch the work. Every now and then when I have time." "Why?" "Were you here the night when they had the rock slide?" "Yes." "I was surprised how quickly and well they cleared the track, when I got the reports about it. It made me think that Neely was a better man than I'd thought." "He isn't." "Was it you who organized the system of moving his day's supplies down to the line?"
"Sure. His men used to spend half their time hunting for things.
Tell him to watch his water tanks. They'll freeze on him one of these nights.
See if you can get him a new ditcher. I don't like the looks of the one he's got. Check on his wiring system."
She looked at him for a moment. "Thanks, Ellis," she said. He smiled and walked on. She watched him as he walked across the bridge, as he started up the long rise toward his derricks.
"He thinks he owns the place, doesn't he?"
She turned, startled. Ben Neely had approached her. His thumb was pointing at Ellis Wyatt. "What place?"
"The railroad, Miss Taggart. Your railroad. Or the whole world, maybe. That's what he thinks."
Ben Neely was a bulky man with a soft, sullen face. His eyes were stubborn and blank. In the bluish light of the snow, his skin had the tinge of butter.
"What does he keep hanging around here for?" he said. "As if nobody knew their business but him, the snooty show-off. Who does he think he is?"
"God damn you," said Dagny evenly, not raising her voice. Neely could never know what had made her say it. But some part of him, in some way of his own, knew it. The shocking thing to her was that he was not shocked. He said nothing. "Let's go to your quarters," she said, wearily pointing to an old railway coach on a spur in the distance. "Have somebody there to take notes."
"Now, about those cross ties, Miss Taggart," he said hastily as they started. "Mr. Coleman of your office okayed them. He didn't say anything about too much bark. I don't see why you think they're..."
"I said you're going to replace them." When she came out of the coach, exhausted by 2 hours of effort to be patient, to instruct, to explain, she saw an automobile parked on the torn dirt road below, a black two-seater, sparkling and new. A new car was an astonishing sight anywhere. One did not see them often. She glanced around and gasped at the sight of the tall figure standing at the foot of the bridge. It was Hank Reardon.
She had not expected to find him in Colorado. He seemed absorbed in calculations, pencil and notebook in hand. His clothes attracted attention, like his car, and for the same reason. He wore a simple trench coat and a hat with a slanting brim. But they were of such good quality, so flagrantly expensive, that they appeared ostentatious among the seedy garments of the crowds everywhere, the more ostentatious because worn so naturally. She noticed suddenly that she was running toward him. She had lost all trace of exhaustion. Then she remembered that she had not seen him since the party. She stopped. He saw her, waved to her in a gesture of pleased, astonished greeting, and he walked forward to meet her. He was smiling. "Hello," he said. "Your first trip to the job?"
"My fifth in 3 months."
"I didn't know you were here. Nobody told me."
"I thought you'd break down someday."
"Break down?"
"Enough to come and see this."
"There's your medal. How do you like it?" He glanced around. "If you ever decide to quit the railroad business, let me know."
"You'd give me a job?"
"Any time." She looked at him for a moment.
"You're only half kidding, Hank. I think you'd like it, having me ask you for a job. Having me for an employee instead of a customer. Giving me orders to obey."
"Yes, I would."
She said, her face hard, "Don't quit the steel business. I won't promise you a job on the railroad."
He laughed. "Don't try it."
"What?"
"To win any battle when I set the terms."
She did not answer.
She was struck by what the words made her feel. It was not an emotion, but a physical sensation of pleasure, which she could not name or understand. "Incidentally," he said, "this is not my first trip. I was here yesterday."
"You were? Why?"
"Well, I came to Colorado on some business of my own, so I thought I'd take a look at this."
"What are you after?"
"Why do you assume that I'm after anything?"
"You wouldn't waste time coming here just to look. Not twice."
He laughed. "True." He pointed at the bridge. "I'm after that."
"What about it?"
"It's ready for the scrap heap."
"Do you suppose that I don't know it?"
"I saw the specifications of your order for Reardon Metal members for that bridge. You're wasting your money. The difference between what you're planning to spend on a makeshift that will last a couple of years and the cost of a new Reardon Metal bridge is comparatively so little that I don't see why you want to bother preserving this museum piece."
"I've thought of a new Reardon Metal bridge. I've had my engineers give me an estimate."
"What did they tell you?"
$2 million.
"Good God!"
"What would you say?"
$800,000.
She looked at him. She knew that he never spoke idly. She asked, trying to sound calm, "How?"
"Like this."
He showed her his notebook. She saw the disjointed notations he had made, a great many figures, a few rough sketches. She understood his scheme before he had finished explaining it. She did not notice that they had sat down, that they were sitting on a pile of frozen lumber, that her legs were pressed to the rough planks, and she could feel the cold through her thin stockings. They were bent together over a few scraps of paper which could make it possible for thousands of tons of freight to cross a cut of empty space. His voice sounded sharp and clear while he explained thrusts, pulls, loads, wind pressures. The bridge was to be a single 1,200-foot truss span. He had devised a new type of truss. It had never been made before, and could not be made except with members that had the strength and the lightness of Reardon metal.
"Hank," she asked, "did you invent this in 2 days?
"Hell no, I invented it long before I had Reardon metal. I figured it out while making steel for bridges. I wanted a metal with which one would be able to do this, among other things. I came here just to see your particular problem for myself."
He chuckled when he saw the slow movement of her hand across her eyes and the line of bitterness in the set of her mouth, as if she were trying to wipe out the things against which she had fought such an exhausting, cheerless battle. "This is only a rough scheme," he said, "but I believe you see what can be done."
"I can't tell you all that I see, Hank."
"Don't bother, I know it. You're saving Tiger Transcontinental for the second time. You used to be a better psychologist than that."
"What do you mean?"
"Why should I give a damn about saving Tiger Transcontinental? Don't you know that I want to have a bridge of Reardon metal to show the country?"
"Yes, Hank, I know it.
There are too many people yelping that rails of Reardon metal are unsafe. So I thought I'd give them something real to yelp about. Let them see a bridge of Reardon metal." She looked at him and laughed aloud in simple delight. "Now what's that?" he asked.
Hank, I don't know anyone, not anyone in the world, who'd think of such an answer to people in such circumstances. Except you.
What about you? Would you want to make the answer with me and face the same screaming?
You knew I would.
Yes, I knew it.
He glanced at her. His eyes narrowed. He did not laugh as she had, but the glance was an equivalent. She remembered suddenly their last meeting at the party. The memory seemed incredible. Their ease with each other, the strange, light-headed feeling, which included the knowledge that it was the only sense of ease either of them found anywhere, made the thought of hostility impossible. Yet she knew that the party had taken place. He acted as if it had not. They walked to the edge of the canyon. Together they looked at the dark drop, at the rise of rock beyond it, at the sun high on the derricks of Wyatt Oil. She stood her feet apart on the frozen stones, braced firmly against the wind. She could feel, without touching it, the line of his chest behind her shoulder. The wind beat her coat against his legs.
Hank, do you think we can build it in time? There are only 6 months left.
Sure, it will take less time and labor than any other type of bridge. Let me have my engineers work out the basic scheme and submit it to you. No obligation on your part. Just take a look at it and see for yourself whether you'll be able to afford it.
You will.
Then you can let your college boys work out the details.
What about the metal?
I'll get the metal rolled if I have to throw every other order out of the mills.
You'll get it rolled on so short a notice?
Have I ever held you up on an order?
No.
But the way things are going nowadays, you might not be able to help it.
Who do you think you're talking to?
Orrin Boyle?
She laughed.
All right. Let me have the drawings as soon as possible. I'll take a look and let you know within 48 hours. As to my college boys, they...
She stopped, frowning.
Hank, why is it so hard to find good men for any job nowadays?
I don't know.
He looked at the lines of the mountains cut across the sky. A thin jet of smoke was rising from a distant valley.
Have you seen the new towns of Colorado and the factories? He asked.
Yes.
It's great, isn't it?
To see the kind of men they've gathered here from every corner of the country. All of them young, all of them starting on a shoestring and moving mountains.
What mountain have you decided to move?
Why?
What are you doing in Colorado?
He smiled.
Looking at a mining property.
What sort?
Copper.
Good God, don't you have enough to do?
I know it's a complicated job, but the supply of copper is becoming completely unreliable.
There doesn't seem to be a single first-rate company left in the business in this country. And I don't want to deal with Dunconia Copper. I don't trust that playboy.
I don't blame you, she said, looking away.
So if there's no competent person left to do it, I'll have to mine my own copper, as I mine my own iron ore. I can't take any chances on being held up by all those failures and shortages. I need a great deal of copper for Reardon Metal.
Have you bought the mine?
Not yet. There are a few problems to solve. Getting the men, the equipment, the transportation.
Oh,
she chuckled. Going to speak to me about building a branch line?
Might.
There's no limit to what's possible in this state. Do you know that they have every kind of natural resource here waiting, untouched, and the way their factories are growing? I feel 10 years younger when I come here.
I don't.
She was looking east, past the mountains. I think of the contrast. All over the rest of the Taggart system, there's less to carry, less tonnage produced each year. It's as if...
Hank, what's wrong with the country?
I don't know. I keep thinking of what they told us in school about the sun losing energy, growing colder each year. I remember wondering, then, what would it be like in the last days of the world?
I think it would be...
like this. Growing colder. And things stopping.
I never believed that story. I thought by the time the sun was exhausted, men would find a substitute.
You did?
Funny, I thought that too.
He pointed at the column of smoke.
There's your new sunrise. It's going to feed the rest.
If it's not stopped.
Do you think it can be stopped?
She looked at the rail under her feet.
No.
She said. He smiled. He looked down at the rail, then let his eyes move along the track up the sides of the mountains to the distant crane. She saw two things, as if for a moment the two stood alone in her field of vision. The lines of his profile, and the green-blue cord coiling through space.
"We've done it, haven't we?" he said.
In payment for every effort, for every sleepless night, for every silent thrust against despair, this moment was all she wanted. "Yes, we have." She looked away, noticed an old crane on the siding, and thought that its cables were worn and would need replacing. This was the great clarity of being beyond emotion, after the reward of having felt everything one could feel. Their achievement, she thought, and one moment of acknowledging it, of possessing it together. What greater intimacy could one share? Now she was free for the simplest, most commonplace concerns of the moment, because nothing could be meaningless within her sight. She wondered what made her certain that he felt as she did. He turned abruptly and started toward his car. She followed. They did not look at each other. "I'm due to leave for the East in an hour," he said. She pointed at the car. "Where did you get that?"
"Here. It's a Hammond, Hammond of Colorado. They're the only people who are still making a good car. I just bought it on this trip."
"Wonderful job."
"Yes, isn't it?"
"Going to drive it back to New York?"
"No, I'm having it shipped. I flew my plane down here."
Oh, you did?" "I drove down from Cheyenne. I had to see the line. But I'm anxious to get home as fast as possible. Would you take me along? Can I fly back with you?"
He did not answer at once. She noticed the empty moment of a pause. "I'm sorry," he said. She wondered whether she imagined the note of abruptness in his voice. "I'm not flying back to New York. I'm going to Minnesota."
"Oh, well, then I'll try to get on an airliner, if I can find one today."
She watched his car vanish down the winding road. She drove to the airport an hour later. The place was a small field at the bottom of a break in the desolate chain of mountains. There were patches of snow on the hard, pitted earth. The pole of a beacon stood at one side, trailing wires to the ground. The other poles had been knocked down by a storm. A lonely attendant came to meet her.
"No, Miss Taggart," he said regretfully. "No planes till day after tomorrow. There's only one transcontinental liner every 2 days, you know, and the one that was due today's been grounded down in Arizona. Engine trouble, as usual," he added. "It's a pity you didn't get here a bit sooner. Mr. Reardon took off for New York in his private plane just a little while ago."
"He wasn't flying to New York, was he?"
"Why, yes. He said so."
"Are you sure?"
"He said he had an appointment there tonight."
She looked at the sky to the east, blankly, without moving. She had no clue to any reason, nothing to give her a foothold, nothing with which to weigh this, or fight it, or understand.
"Damn these streets," said James Taggart. "We're going to be late."
Dagny glanced ahead, past the back of the chauffeur. Through the circle made by a windshield wiper on the sleet-streaked glass, she saw black, worn, glistening car tops strung in a motionless line. Far ahead, the smear of a red lantern low over the ground marked a street excavation.
"There's something wrong on every other street," said Taggart irritably. "Why doesn't somebody fix them?"
She leaned back against the seat, tightening the collar of her wrap. She felt exhausted at the end of a day that had started at her desk in her office at 7 a.m., a day she had broken off, uncompleted, to rush home and dress because she had promised Jim to speak at the dinner of the New York Business Council.
"They want us to give them a talk about Reardon Metal," he had said. "You can do it so much better than I. It's very important that we present a good case. There's such a controversy about Reardon Metal."
Seated beside him in his car, she regretted that she had agreed. She looked at the streets of New York and thought of the race between metal and time, between the rails of the Rio Norte line and the passing days. She felt as if her nerves were being pulled tight by the stillness of the car, by the guilt of wasting an evening when she could not afford to waste an hour.
"With all those attacks on Reardon that one hears everywhere," said Taggart, "he might need a few friends."
She glanced at him incredulously.
"You mean you want to stand by him?"
He did not answer at once. He asked, his voice bleak,
That report of the Special Committee of the National Council of Metal Industries? What do you think of it?
You know what I think of it. They said Reardon metal is a threat to public safety. They said its chemical composition is unsound. It's brittle, it's decomposing molecularly, and it will crack suddenly without warning.